This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, The Tommyknockers, by Stephen King. Copyright 1987 by Stephen King, Tabitha King, and Arthur B. Green, trustee. Narrated by Pam Ward. This book contains 558 pages on 18 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. Curiosity compels a young woman to unearth a mysterious, faintly vibrating metal object that she discovers while walking in the main woods. No sooner does the excavation begin than her small New England town is besieged with bizarre, terrifying, and gruesome occurrences. Strong language and violence. Bestseller, 1987. From the book jacket. Late last night and the night before. Tommyknockers knocking at the door. I want to go out. Don't know if I can, because I'm so afraid of the Tommyknocker man. It begins with nothing more frightening than a nursery rhyme. Yet in Stephen King's hands it becomes an unforgettable parable of dread, a threat from an unimaginable darkness that drags the practical inhabitants of a New England village into a hell worse than their own most horrible nightmares, and yours. It begins with a writer named Roberta Anderson, looking for firewood in the forest that stretches behind her house. Bobby stumbles over 3 inches of metal, which unusually heavy spring runoff has left sticking out of the soil. A logger's beer can, she thinks at first, but the metal was as solid as mother rock. It begins with Bobby's discovery of the ship in the earth, a ship buried for millions of years, but still vibrating faintly, still humming with some sort of life. Faint, weak, but still better left alone. Bobby then begins to dig, tentatively at first, then compulsively, and is joined by her old friend and one-time lover, Jim Gardner. Aided by a weirdly advanced technology, their excavation proceeds apace. And as they uncover more and more of an artifact both familiar and so unbelievable it is almost beyond comprehension, the inhabitants of Haven start to change. There is a new hot water heater in Bobby's basement, a hot water heater that apparently runs on flashlight batteries. The vengeful housewife who learns of her husband's affair from a picture of Jesus on top of her TV, a picture that begins to talk. Not to mention the 10-year-old magician who makes his little brother disappear. For real. The townspeople of Haven are becoming, being welded into one organic, homicidal, and fearsomely brilliant entity in fatal thrall to the Tommyknockers. In this riveting, nightmarish story, Stephen King has given us his tautest, most terrifying novel to date. And the next time someone raps at your door, you may want to keep the chain on. It just might be the Tommyknocker man. About the author. Stephen King's most recent works are It, The Eyes of the Dragon, and Misery. He and his wife, the novelist Tabitha King, live in Bangor, Maine with their 3 children. Other books by Stephen King. Novel. Carrie. Salem's Lot. The Shining. The Stand. The Dead Zone. Firestarter. Cujo. The Dark Tower. Christine. Pet Cemetery. The Talisman. With Peter Straub. As Richard Bachman, Rage, The Long Walk, Roadwork, The Running Man, Sinner. Collections, Night Shift, Different Seasons, Skeleton Crew. Nonfiction, Danse Macabre. Screenplays, Creepshow, Cat's Eye, Silver Bullet, Maximum Overdrive. The Tommyknockers. For Tabitha King, Promises to Keep. Like many of the Mother Goose rhymes, the verse about the Tommyknockers is deceptively simple. The origin of the word is difficult to trace. Webster's Unabridged says Tommyknockers are either A, tunneling ogres, or B, ghosts which haunt deserted mines or caves. Because Tommy is an archaic British slang term referring to army rations, leading to the term Tommies as a word used to identify British conscripts as in Kipling, it's Tommy this and Tommy that, the Oxford Unabridged Dictionary, while not identifying the term itself, at least suggests that Tommyknockers are the ghosts of miners who died of starvation, but still go knocking for food and rescue. The first verse, late last night and the night before, etc., is common enough for my wife and myself to have heard it as children, although we were raised in different towns, different faiths, and came from different descendants. Hers primarily French, mine Scots-Irish. All other verses are products of the author's imagination. That author, me, in other words, wishes to thank his spouse, Tabitha, who is an invaluable, if sometimes maddening, critic. If you get mad at critics, you almost always can be sure they are right. The editor, Alan Williams, for his kind and careful attention, Phyllis Graham for her patience, this book was not so much written as gutted out, and in particular George Everett McCutcheon, who has read each of my novels and vetted it carefully, primarily for weapons and ballistics reasons, but also for his attention to continuity. Mac died while this book was in rewrite. In fact, I was obediently making corrections suggested by one of his notes when I learned that he had finally succumbed to the leukemia he had battled for nearly 2 years. I miss him terribly. Not because he helped me fix things, but because he was part of my heart's neighborhood. Thanks are due to others, more than I could name. Pilots, dentists, geologists, fellow writers, even my kids, who listened to the book aloud. I'm also grateful to Stephen Jay Gould. Although he is a Yankee fan and thus not entirely to be trusted, his comments on the possibilities of what I'd call dumb evolution helped to shape the redraft of this novel, e.g. the flamingo smile. Haven is not real. The characters are not real. This is a work of fiction with one exception. The Tommyknockers are real. If you think I'm kidding, you missed the nightly news. Stephen King. Late last night and the night before, Tommyknockers, Tommyknockers knocking at the door. I want to go out, don't know if I can, 'cause I'm so afraid of the Tommyknocker man. Traditional. Book 1, The Ship in the Earth. Well, we picked up Harry Truman floating down from Independence. We said, what about the war? He said, good riddance. We said, what about the bomb? Are you sorry that you did it? He said, pass me that bottle and mind your own business. The Rainmakers. Downstream. Chapter 1. Anderson Stumbles. 1. For want of a nail, the kingdom was lost. That's how the catechism goes when you boil it down. In the end, you can boil everything down to something similar. Or so Roberta Anderson thought much later on. It's either all an accident or all fate. Anderson literally stumbled over her destiny in the small town of Haven, Maine on June 21st, 1988. That stumble was the root of the matter. All the rest was nothing but history. 2. Anderson was out that afternoon with Peter, an aging beagle who was now blind in one eye. Peter had been given to her by Jim Gardner in 1976. Anderson had left college the year before with her degree only 2 months away to move on to her uncle's place in Haven. She hadn't realized how lonely she'd been until Gard brought the dog. He'd been a pup then. And Anderson sometimes found it difficult to believe he was now old, 84 in dog's years. It was a way of measuring her own age. 1976 had receded. Yes, indeed. When you were 25, you could still indulge in the luxury of believing that in your case, at least, growing up was a clerical error which would eventually be rectified. When you woke up one day and discovered your dog was 84 and you yourself were 37, that was a view that had to be re-examined. Yes, indeed. Anderson was looking for a place to cut some wood. She'd a cord and a half laid by, but wanted at least another 3 to take her through the winter. She had cut a lot since those early days when Peter had been a pup, sharpening his teeth on an old slipper, and wetting all too often on the dining room rug. But the place was still not short. The property, still after 13 years mostly referred to by the townspeople as the old Garrett place, had only 180 feet on Route 9, but the rock walls marking the north and south boundaries marched off at diverging angles. Another rock wall, This one so old it had degenerated into isolated rock middens furred with moss, marked the property's rear boundary about 3 miles into an unruly forest of first and second growth trees. The total acreage of this pie-shaped wedge was huge. Beyond the wall, at the western edge of Bobby Anderson's land, were miles of wilderness owned by the New England Paper Company. Burning woods on the map. In truth, Anderson didn't really need to hunt a place to do her cutting. The land her mother's brother had left her was valuable because most of the trees on it were good hardwood, relatively untouched by the gypsy moth infestation. But this day was lovely and warm after a rainy spring. The garden was in the ground, where most of it would rot, thanks to the rain, and it wasn't yet time to start the new book. So she had covered the typewriter, and here she was with faithful old one-eyed Peter, rambling. There was an old logging road behind the farm, and she followed this almost a mile before striking off to the left. She was wearing a pack, a sandwich and a book in it for her, dog biscuits for Peter, and lots of orange ribbon to tie around the trunks of the trees she would want to cut as September's heat ebbed toward October, and a canteen. She had a silver compass in her pocket. She had gotten lost on the property only once, and once was enough to last her forever. She had spent a terrible night in the woods, simultaneously unable to believe she had actually gotten lost on property she, for Christ's sweet sake, owned, and sure she would die out here, a possibility in those days, because only Jim would know she was missing, and Jim only came when you weren't expecting him. In the morning, Peter had led her to a stream, and the stream had led her back to Route 9, where it burbled cheerfully through a culvert under the tar only 2 miles from home. Nowadays, she probably had enough wood savvy to find her way back to the road, or to one of the rock walls bounding her land, but the key word was probably. So she carried a compass. She found a good stand of maple around 3 o'clock. In fact, she had found several other good stands of wood, but this one was close to a path she knew, a path wide enough to accommodate the tomcat. Come September 20th or so, if someone didn't blow the world up in the meantime, she would hook her sledge up to the tomcat, drive in here, and do some cutting. Besides, she had walked enough for one day. Look good, Pete? Pete barked feebly, and Anderson looked at the beagle with a sadness so deep it surprised and disquieted her. Peter was done up. He seldom took after birds and squirrels and chipmunks and the occasional woodchuck these days. The thought of Peter running a deer was laughable. She would have to take a good many rest stops on the way back for him. And there had been a time, not that long ago, or so her mind stubbornly maintained, when Peter would always have been a quarter of a mile ahead of her, belling volleys of barks back through the woods. She thought there might come a day when she would decide enough was enough. She'd pat the seat on the passenger side of the Chevrolet pickup for the last time and take Peter to the vet down in Augusta. But not this summer, please God. Or this fall or winter, please God, or ever, please God. Because without Peter, she would be alone. Except for Jim. And Jim Gardner had gotten more than just a trifle wiggy over the last 8 years or so. Still a friend, but wiggy. Glad you approve, Pete, old man, she said, putting a ribbon or two around the trees, knowing perfectly well she might decide to cut another stand and the ribbons would rot here. Your taste is only exceeded by your good looks. Peter, knowing what was expected of him, he was old but not stupid, wagged his scraggy stub of a tail and barked. Be a Viet Cong, Anderson ordered. Peter obediently fell on his side, a little wheeze escaped him, and rolled on his back, legs splayed out. That almost always amused Anderson, but today the sight of her dog playing Viet Cong, Peter would also play dead at the words pooch or me lie, was too close to what she had been thinking about. Up, Pete. Pete got up slowly, panting below his muzzle. His white muzzle. Let's go back. She tossed him a dog biscuit. Peter snapped at it and missed. He snuffed for it, missed it, then came back to it. He ate it slowly, without much relish. Right, Anderson said. Move out. 3. For want of a shoe, the kingdom was lost. For the choice of a path, the ship was found. Anderson had been down here before in the 13 years that the Garrick place hadn't become the Anderson place. She recognized the slope of land, a deadfall left by pulpers who had probably all died before the Korean War, a great pine with a split top. She had walked this land before and would have no trouble finding her way back to the path she would use with a tomcat. She might have passed the spot where she stumbled once or twice or half a dozen times before, perhaps by yards or feet or bare inches. This time, she followed Peter as the dog moved slightly to the left, and with the path in sight, one of her elderly hiking boots fetched up against something. Fetched up hard. "Hey!" she yelled, but it was too late. In spite of her pinwheeling arms, she fell to the ground. The branch of a low bush scratched her cheek hard enough to bring blood. "Shit!" she cried, and a blue jay scolded her. Peter returned, first sniffing and then licking her nose.
"Christ, don't do that! Your breath stinks!"
Peter wagged his tail. Anderson sat up. She rubbed her left cheek and saw blood on her palm and fingers. She grunted. "Nice going," she said, and looked to see what she had tripped over. A fallen piece of tree, most likely, or a rock poking out of the ground. Lots of rock in Maine. What she saw was a gleam of metal. She touched it, running her finger along it, and then blowing off Black Forest dirt. "What's this?" she asked Peter. Peter approached, sniffed at it, and then did a peculiar thing. The beagle backed off two dog paces, sat down, and uttered a single low howl. "Who got on your case?" Anderson asked, but Peter only sat there. Anderson hooked herself closer, still sitting down, sliding on the seat of her jeans. She examined the metal in the ground. Roughly 3 inches stuck out of the mulchy earth, just enough to trip over. There was a slight rise here, and perhaps the runoff from the heavy spring rains had freed it. Anderson's first thought was that the skidders who had logged this land in the 20s and 30s must have buried a bunch of their leavings here, the cast-off swill of a 3-day cutting, which in those days had been called a logger's weekend. A tin can, she thought. B&M beans or Campbell's soup. She wiggled it the way you'd wiggle a tin can out of the earth. Then it occurred to her that no one except a toddler would be apt to trip over the leading edge of a can. The metal in the earth didn't wiggle. It was as solid as Mother Rock. A piece of old logging equipment, maybe? Intrigued, Anderson examined it more closely, not seeing that Peter had gotten to his feet, backed away another 4 paces, and sat down again. The metal was a dull gray, not the bright color of tin or iron at all. And it was thicker than a can, maybe a 1/4 inch at its top. Anderson placed the pad of her right index finger on this edge and felt a momentary odd tingling, like a vibration. She took her finger away and looked at it quizzically. Put it back. Nothing. No buzz. Now she pinched it between her thumb and finger and tried to draw it from the earth like a loose tooth from a gum. It didn't come. She was gripping the protrusion in the rough center. It sank back into the earth, or that was the impression she had then, on either side at a width of less than 2 inches. She would later tell Jim Gardner that she could have walked past it 3 times a day for 40 years and never stumbled over it. She brushed away loose soil, exposing a little more of it. She dug a channel along it about 2 inches deep with her fingers. The soil gave easily enough, as forest soil does, at least until you hit the webwork of roots. It continued smoothly down into the ground. Anderson got up on her knees and dug down along either side. She tried wiggling it again. Still no go. She scraped away more soil with her fingers and quickly exposed more. Now she saw 6 inches of gray metal. Now 9. Now 1 foot. It's a car or a truck or a skidder, she thought suddenly, buried out here in the middle of nowhere. Or maybe a Hooverville kind of stove. But why here? No reason that she could think of. No reason at all. She found things in the woods from time to time, shell casings, beer cans, The oldest, not with pop-tops, but with triangle-shaped holes made by what they had called a church key back in those dim, dead days of the 1960s. Candy wrappers, other stuff. Haven was not on either of Maine's two major tourist tracks, one of which runs through the lake and mountain region to the extreme west of the state, and the other of which runs up the coast to the extreme east. But it had not been the forest primeval for a long, long time. Once, she had been over the decayed stone wall at the back of her land and actually trespassing on New England Paper Company's land at the time, she had found the rusted hulk of a late 40s Hudson Hornet standing in what had once been a woods road, and what was now, over 20 years after the cutting had stopped, a tangle of second growth, what the locals called shitwood. No reason that hulk of a car should have been there either, but it was easier to explain than a stove or a refrigerator or any other damn thing actually buried in the ground. She had dug twin trenches a foot long on either side of the object without finding its end. She got down almost a foot before scraping her fingers on rock. She might have been able to pull the rock out. That, at least, had some wiggle. But there was no reason to do it. The object in the earth continued down past it. Peter whined. Anderson glanced at the dog, then stood up. Both knees popped. Her left foot tingled with pins and needles. She fished her pocket watch out of her pants, old and tarnished. The Simon watch was another part of her legacy from Uncle Frank, and was astonished to see that she had been here a long time, an hour and a quarter at least. It was past 4. "Come on, Pete," she said, "let's bug out." Peter whined again, but still wouldn't move. And now, with real concern, Anderson saw that her old beagle was shivering all over, as if with ague. She had no idea if dogs could catch ague, but thought old ones might. She did recollect that the only time she had ever seen Peter shiver like that was in the fall of 1977, or maybe it had been 78. There had been a catamount on the place. Over a series of perhaps 9 nights, it had screamed and squalled, very likely in unrequited heat. Each night, Peter would go to the living room window and jump up on the old church pew Anderson kept there by her bookcase. He never barked. He only looked out into the dark toward that unearthly, womanish squealing, nostrils flaring, ears up. And he shivered. Anderson stepped over her little excavation and went to Peter. She knelt down and ran her hands along the sides of Peter's face, feeling the shiver in her palm. "What's wrong, boy?" she murmured. But she knew what was wrong. Peter's good eye shifted past her toward the thing in the earth, and then back to Anderson. The plea in the eye not veiled by the hateful, milky cataract was as clear as speech. "Let's get out of here, Bobby. I like that thing almost as much as I like your sister." "Okay," Anderson said uneasily. It suddenly occurred to her that she could not remember ever having lost track of time as she had today, out here. "Peter doesn't like it. I don't either." "Come on." She started up the slope to the path. Peter followed with alacrity. They were almost to the path when Anderson, like Lot's wife, looked back. If not for that last glance, she might actually have let the whole thing go. Since leaving college before finals, in spite of her mother's tearful pleas and her sister's furious diatribes and baleful ultimatums, Anderson had gotten good at letting things go. The look back from this middle distance showed her 2 things. First, the thing did not sink back into the earth as she had at first thought. The tongue of metal was sticking up in the middle of a fairly fresh declivity, not wide, but fairly deep, and surely the result of late winter runoff and the heavy spring rains that had followed it. So the ground to either side of the protruding metal was higher, and the metal simply disappeared back into it. Her first impression, that the thing in the ground was the corner of something, wasn't true after all. Or not necessarily true. Second, it looked like a plate. Not a plate you'd eat from, but a dull metal plate, like metal siding or... Peter barked. "Okay," Anderson said. "I hear you talking. Let's go." "Let's go, and let's let it go." She walked up the center of the path, letting Peter lead them back toward the woods road at his own bumbling pace, enjoying the lush green of high summer. And this was the first day of summer, wasn't it? The solstice. Longest day of the year. She slapped a mosquito and grinned. Summer was a good time in Haven, the best of times. And if Haven wasn't the best of places, parked as it was well above Augusta, in that central part of the state most tourists pass by, it was still a good place to come to rest. There had been a time when Anderson had honestly believed she would only be here a few years, long enough to recover from the traumas of adolescence, her sister, and her abrupt, confused withdrawal, surrender, Anne called it, from college. But a few years had become 5, 5 had become 10, 10 had become 13, and looky here, Huck, Peter's old and you got a pretty good crop of gray coming up in what used to be hair as black as the River Styx. She tried cropping it close 2 years ago, almost a punk do, had been horrified to find it made the gray even more noticeable, and had let it grow ever since. She now thought she might spend the rest of her life in Haven, with the sole exception of the duty trip she took to visit her publisher in New York every year or two. The town got you. The place got you. The land got you. And that wasn't so bad. It was as good as anything else, maybe. Like a plate. A metal plate. She broke off a short, limber branch, well-plumed with fresh green leaves, and waved it around her head. The mosquitoes had found her and seemed determined to have their high tea off her. Mosquitoes whirling around her head, and thoughts like mosquitoes inside her head. Those she couldn't wave off. It vibrated under my finger for a second. I felt it, like a tuning fork. But when I touched it, it stopped. Is it possible for something to vibrate in the earth like that? Surely not. Maybe it had been a psychic vibration. She did not absolutely disbelieve in such things. Maybe her mind had sensed something about that buried object and had told her about it in the only way it could, by giving her a tactile impression, one of vibration. Peter had certainly sensed something about it. The old beagle hadn't wanted to go near it. Forget it. She did. For a little while. 4. That night, a high, mild wind arose, and Anderson went out on her front porch to smoke and listen to the wind walk and talk. At one time, even a year earlier, Peter would have come out with her, but now he remained in the parlor, curled up on his small, hooked rug by the stove, nose to tail. Anderson found her mind replaying that last look back at the plate sticking out of the earth, and she later came to believe that there was a moment, perhaps when she flicked the cigarette into the gravel drive, when she decided she would have to dig it up and see what it was, although she didn't consciously recognize the decision then. Her mind worried restlessly at what it might be, and this time she allowed it to run. She had learned that if your mind insisted on returning to a topic, no matter how you tried to divert it, it was best to let it return. Only obsessives worried about obsession. Part of some building, her mind hazarded. A prefab. But no one built Quonset huts out in the woods. Why drag all that metal in when 3 men could throw up a cutter's lean-to with saws, axes, and a 2-handed bucksaw in 6 hours? Not a car, either, or the protruding metal would have been flaked with rust. An engine block seemed slightly more likely, but why? And now, with dark drawing down, that memory of vibration returned with inarguable certainty. It must have been a psychic vibration, if she had felt it at all. Suddenly a cold and terrible certainty rose in her. Someone was buried there. Maybe she had uncovered the leading edge of a car, or an old refrigerator, or even some sort of steel trunk, but whatever it had been in its above-ground life, it was now a coffin. A murder victim? Who else would be buried in such a way, in such a box? Guys who happened to wander into the woods during hunting season and got lost there and died there didn't carry along metal caskets to pop themselves into when they died. And even given such an idiotic idea, who would shovel the dirt back in? Cut me a break, folks, as we used to say back in the glorious days of our youth. The vibration. It had been the call of human bones. Come on, Bobby, don't be so fucking stupid. A shudder worked through her, nevertheless. The idea had a certain weird persuasiveness, like a Victorian ghost story that had no business working as the world hurtled down Microchip Alley toward the unknown wonders and horrors of the 21st century, but somehow produced the goose flesh just the same. She could hear Anne laughing and saying, "You're getting as funny in the head as Uncle Frank, Bobby, and it's just what you deserve, living out there alone with your smelly dog." Sure, cabin fever. The hermit complex. Call the doctor, call the nurse. Bobby's bad and getting worse.